From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The important relationships in our lives are rich, they're rewarding, and they're complex. But as we all know, relationships take work.
I was a little shocked about, what do you mean you don't talk? Or what do you mean you don't share? Or why is that so difficult?
But how much work does it take to fake a relationship?
Yeah. Would you ever consider getting a desktop computer? Or even, you have a queen, right? I saw your bed. It's huge. Yeah. Do you wear pajamas?
And what happens when your work life and your home life are one and the same?
Recording an album together, it's a proof of love because it's not easy.
The prickly world of relationships. That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Hey, thanks for listening to Latino USA. And if you like us, take a listen to our friends over at Alt Latino. It's a weekly dive into the world of Latin alternative music and culture, featuring sounds like psychedelic tropical music from Peru or Mexican folk rhythms mixed with electronica. Hear from the artists changing and challenging the established order of Latin music. That's Alt Latino from NPR Music every week at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And this week, one of our producers, Antonia Cerejido, took me into the studio and sat me down because she had a question for me.
Do you know what a DTR conversation is?
DTR. I know what off the record, it's OTR.
DTR. Take a guess.
Don't tell Ralph. Can you give me a hint?
Yeah, it's like something that a couple does.
I am so intrigued.
It's define the relationship.
Wait, this is what like young people are doing? We're having a DTR. So my husband and I, we DTR'd a relationship over 25 years ago. But of course, romantic relationships aren't the only relationships in our lives that need to be defined. We define our relationship to our parents, to our kids, to our jobs, and even to ourselves. And that's what this week's show is all about, defining the relationship. And to start our show, Antonia is going to take us through an extreme DTR moment. What happens when couples need to prove their marriage to the government?
It's hard enough to have this conversation of where are we? Are we a real couple within the relationship? But for many immigrants coming to the U.S. seeking a marriage visa, they have to be able to prove their relationship in a marriage fraud interview. I talked to Alan Warnick, a law professor at Baruch College.
It's important to note that not every marriage case requires a marriage fraud interview.
Marriage fraud is when two people who are not a real couple get married just so one of them can get legal status, what's often called getting married for papers. And the U.S. citizens who participate in marriage fraud are often either friends of the person who wants to be a citizen and or they're getting paid.
I heard up to $50,000 in some cases.
And so the interview only comes up when suspicions arise that the couple might not be a real couple, a real marriage. At the interview, the couple has to bring documents to back up their relationship.
Photos with the family, because if it's a phony marriage, you're less likely to introduce your spouse to your family members.
What sorts of questions are asked?
Favorite restaurant, favorite drink, presents that were given at holidays or birthdays or anniversaries. You know, what color are the walls in the bathroom? But what I always tell my clients is that if it's a bona fide marriage, you'll pass. At some point, you'll pass the interview if it's a real marriage.
That got me thinking, how hard is it to pass if you're not in a real marriage?
Usually within 5 questions, I can establish it's a phony marriage.
What if we have some couples that are real and then some couples that are not real who have studied your questions and you come in and try to figure out which is the real couple and which is the fake couple?
I think it'd be very fun and I bet I can find out.
We're going to do that. Operation Trick Immigration Lawyer was a go. First step, pick the couples. We picked two real couples, Joan Gary, our consultant, and her wife Eileen, and then Jennifer Argueta, who works on our admin side, and her husband Luis. On the fake side, Michael Simon Johnson, one of our producers and the engineer here, would be married to Paola.
She used to work here. We are friends outside of the office. And I know her pretty well.
And do you think that you're going to be able to pull this off?
Yes, I do.
Our second fake couple is Annette Nielsen and Ted Canova. Both are in their 50s. Annette's married, Ted's divorced, and they both work in our office. And for Ted, the idea of any marriage, even a fake one, is stressful. Who proposed to who in this fake marriage?
We can be traditional.
All right, I proposed to you.
How did you do it?
Oh, my God. The only thing is I can...
Well, come up with something. However you did it before.
Oh, no, I can't do that.
Oh, let's just say in a ski slope, you know?
Okay.
She didn't hesitate. She was like, ski slope. She knew.
Chairlift.
Where did you meet in your fake... In your fake marriage?
All right, in band.
No, I'm in a... No, I can't do anything. I'm in a community band. I can't do any of the stuff that I'm really true.
But it's more fun that way.
We met in New York City at a restaurant.
Really?
Oh, no, that's awful.
Yeah.
Our fake couples had 2 days to prepare. Michael and Paola took their backstory very seriously. They filled out a list of 100 questions that Alan, the lawyer, sent us. Here's Michael prepping with Paola on the phone.
Yeah. Would you ever consider getting a desktop computer, or even, you have a queen, right? I saw your bed, it's huge. Yeah. Do you wear pajamas?
I didn't want to venture out today.
Do you use Dr. Browner's at all? Oh. You should get on that, it's great.
After working out their respective stories, our couples were ready to go. And so, we started the test. For each pair, Alan would separate the couple and ask them the same question one at a time. We started with the actually married Joan and Eileen.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you today?
Very good.
Good. How long did you two know each other before you got married?
34 years. We met in 1981.
That's a long relationship.
Indeed.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
What kind of living arrangement do you have? Apartment, house?
We live in a home. We live in a house.
And how many bedrooms?
Three. There are 4 bedrooms in our house.
So your spouse said there were 3 bedrooms. You think one of them maybe
a den
or something?
Oh, one of them is like a den.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Only 3 questions? You feel confident that you'll be able to know?
People who have known each other for 34 years, that's going to be pretty hard to determine whether it's a real marriage or not. And, the apartment issue is fine.
So Alan determined that Joan and Eileen were a real marriage. The next couple was Michael and Paola. Let's see if all of their studying paid off.
So how did you and your spouse meet?
We met here.
So I started working here actually 2 years ago.
And do you live in an apartment or a house?
We live in an apartment.
We live in a house currently.
And what floor is it on?
It's on the first and the second floor.
We have first two. And second floor.
Yeah.
So your husband said that you lived in an apartment. 2 apartments, he said.
It's 2 apartments and 1 house. We live on the first 2 floors of the house.
So, I see.
Yeah, whatever you want to call it.
How many bathrooms are there?
There's 2 full bathrooms, which is actually one of my favorite things about.
And what color is the paint in the bathrooms?
Yellow in one, and...
It is a light yellow.
All right, thank you very much.
Yeah.
So, verdict?
Real marriage. Seems like a real marriage to me. You know, they, again, very relaxed, answered all the questions, weren't flustered by the discrepancy.
We got them. Michael and Paula were actually able to fool an immigration lawyer. Up next, Jennifer and Luis, who are real life married.
How did you meet your wife?
It was over the phone.
It was over the phone.
What was the last vacation you took?
We were in Guatemala.
We go there a lot.
You speak Spanish?
I, más o menos.
And does your husband speak Spanish?
He does.
Where are you from?
Guatemala.
What were you doing there?
Beginning an adoption process.
We're in the middle of an adoption.
I see. And how did that go?
It's still going.
It's ongoing.
All right, thank you very much. Well, again, you know, an adoption in Guatemala, that's an awful tall tale to tell. So I've decided that that is probably a real marriage.
So at that point, Alan was 2 out of 3. Lastly, the other fake couple, Ted and Annette.
Annette, how long have you and your spouse been married?
About 10 years.
We've been married since 06.
Uh-huh. How did you meet your husband?
We met at a Bruce Springsteen concert.
I'm a big Bruce Springsteen fan, so I travel with him.
We're both kind of
Bruce buds, as they call them.
Were you sitting next to each other?
No, I wasn't. I was further up.
We didn't start sitting together. There were some empty seats in my row.
And I noticed an empty seat. And
were you with friends?
No, I went by myself.
And did he have friends with him?
I think he was with a group.
I was by myself. I go to shows
no
by
friends
myself
or
all
anything.
The time.
You're just hanging out by yourself.
That's kind of what I do. Yeah.
And do you all have bicycles? I'm suspicious of this marriage. I wouldn't deny it just on the basis of the interview so far. But she was very vague about how they met, and he contradicted what she said. She said he was with friends in a group, and he said he was by himself. It could be that, you know, it's just sort of a misunderstanding, but I have to say I'm very suspicious about this one.
So it was time to announce the results. All the couples went around the room and told Alan whether they were real or not.
So if we want to start going around the...
Starting with Jonah and Eileen.
We are a real couple. but have only been married for a year and a half.
And the
country only believes we've been together for a year and a half, even though we've been together for 34. Correct.
Well put.
Then Paola and Michael.
We are definitely not a real couple. Although we are friends, so.
Yeah.
But we did lie about the paint color on the walls.
Yeah, we both came up with
the
same lie.
I didn't know what he would say.
You guys both came up with light yellow?
Yes.
Yeah. So for the record, possibly the reason why we stumped you is because we got extremely lucky.
Yeah.
In my experience, the couples who are not married but who are successful in convincing the immigration service that they're married are people who know each other for a while.
And Jennifer and Luis?
We are a real couple.
Real couple?
Yes.
And best of luck with the adoption.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And last but not least, the Bruce Buds, Ted and Annette.
We are not a real couple.
Surprise!
Annette is happily married. And as I said to Antonia, I am an eligible bachelor, so.
As you can tell, we had a blast putting on this fake marriage test. But this does happen in real life. A lot. In fact, in 2014, an immigration and customs official estimated that between 5 and 15% of marriage visas go to sham marriages. That means that there are potentially tens of thousands of fake marriages a year. According to Alan, none of our interviews would have been enough to deny someone a visa. They were just too short. He would have had to ask some more questions. But when fake couples are caught, the consequences are real.
I should point out that if you engage in a fraudulent marriage, and you are the person who wants to be a permanent resident, and it is determined that it was fraudulent, then you are forever barred, forever getting permanent residence, except in very limited situations like asylum.
Did you catch that? If you're the one trying to get a visa and you get caught, you can never get permanent residence here. And if you're the citizen and you're caught, you could be fined up to $250,000 or face 5 years in prison. But chances are,
for the U.S. citizen, unless it's you're a serial, you know, phony marriage person, it's unlikely you'll be prosecuted. But it's a very risky thing for the what the law calls the alien, you know, the permanent resident applicant. So just suggest to your friends that they really think carefully about it before they do it.
Yes, marriage is a really big decision. And it's hard enough to do it for real, let alone for fake. But if you're curious to learn more about marriage fraud interviews, check out our website, latinousa.org. We put up the full list of questions given to us by attorney Alan Wernick. And coming up on Latino USA, relationships take on a completely new meaning when it comes to foster care.
There are so many other systems that touch our families' lives, and if we're not working in unison and trying to really move in the trauma-informed direction, I think we're missing the boat.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Calor y se hayan pasado los aguaceros. Cuelga la noche de un farol.
So before we get back to our show, I want to read you something that one of our new donors wrote. She said, "You finally got me. I'm donating now after months of listening to Maria ask during the show, because if any podcast deserves the support, it's Latino USA." Those are the words from our recent new donor, Melissa, who goes on to say that she finds each week Latino USA is even more engaging, enlightening, and inspiring. Melissa, your thoughts about the Perdóname segment in the miscommunications episode had us all laughing out loud in the office because, yes, we've all been there. Thank you so much. I do hope you'll consider joining Melissa and other amazing listeners like her who have gone to latinousa.org and clicked on the donate button. Every single penny helps in bringing you independent media. Thanks so much. Muchas gracias.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, whose National Hispanic Advisory Council is devoted to educating the Hispanic community about the causes, treatment, and prevention of cancer. Learn more at cancercenter.com. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today it's all about relationships. So, in most weddings, one person presides over the ceremony. It's a wedding officiant. But wouldn't it make more sense, actually, to have two people who've already been there do it? I mean, who better to bring a couple together than another couple? Well, the Reverends Luisa Porata and Deidre Kearney do just that. They met more than 45 years ago, and they've been together ever since. They worked as nurses in New York City during the AIDS crisis, and at that time, they learned practices like therapeutic touch and aromatherapy. Eventually, they decided to become ministers, and the two were married themselves in 2011. Now, as a registered wedding officiant in the state of New York, Luisa specializes in bilingual Spanish and English weddings. She marries and counsels couples with her partner, Deidre, at her side.
Hi, I'm Reverend Luisa Parada. I am an interfaith wedding officiant.
Hi, I'm Reverend Deidre Kearney. I'm Luisa Parada's partner. Luisa and I both decided we wanted to get married down at City Hall. And we had a couple of friends come with us and stand up for us.
We've seen the big weddings. And we figured something small and loving for us would be just fine with the friends that we had there.
In my youth, I was not one of those people who was dying to be married. I thought, that doesn't make any sense. Why do you have to be married? What for? But now that I'm working with Luisa, who's always, even as a little five-year-old, she would make believe she was getting married or doing weddings or whatever. And I was just totally the opposite, little tomboy. But I do see the beauty of it now.
I love to see the bride come down the aisle. I have to say that. I'm a people person. I like to watch people. I love to see the groom's face when she comes up. He's like anxiously waiting for her. Something happens when I'm up there officiating. I really love seeing the look on the couple's faces when I say the words that touch their heart.
Something seems to happen at a certain point toward the end, and I actually start crying, and I don't cry easily, you know. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, and I'm just so proud. Together, we do counseling for the couples. Both of us are different cultures. Luisa's Puerto Rican, and I'm African American. The two of us together are able to bring our own backgrounds into play. So sometimes sitting and talking to couples and seeing that, you know, one of the questions Luisa will ask is, where do you feel that you have areas of your relationship that are the most difficult for you? And we'll really sit and listen to their answer, because many times that'll give us ideas about our own relationship.
But for myself, I try to go away with and I try to think, do I say those kinds of things? Am I the one that always has to have my way and have the last word? And we recently pre-counseled a couple that will be getting married soon. And they wanted to know what was like the secret of our staying together. And what we explained to them was, you know, we change with time. We do different things. We allow each other the space to grow in different directions. And you need a date night. You need a night where you guys can go off without the kids, if you have children, without all the different stresses from your work life, and enjoy one moment in time that shows each other that love is still there, that spark is still there, no matter how many years you stay together. Before the law was passed for marriage equality, we really couldn't come out and tell people about ourselves. And it was just beautiful to see that now we're able to be more open.
With the passage of the law, especially among young people, they're much more open. Once you are able to change your view of who you are as a person, that you are a person, that you are a person of worth, people generally seem to change also. That's really, I think, the basis of what has changed today, that people can change their image and their thoughts of themselves, and then you can hopefully help change society for the better.
Reverends Luisa Porata and Deirdre Kearney. Our piece was produced by Nomin Ojiadine. So much of what Luisa and Deirdre have done, they've done together. And that's crucial to sustaining a healthy relationship. Of course, if a healthy relationship starts to break down, it can also lead to stress. Our senior producer, Daisy Rosario, has been reporting on a particular kind of stress called toxic stress for a while now. Now, toxic stress isn't the same as regular stress. It's a term for the response the body has when exposed to frequent adversity without adequate protection. So, think of a child suffering from things like abuse, neglect, or being exposed to violence and not receiving the proper care. Or maybe the child's caregiver suffers from addiction or mental illness. All of this affects the way the brain is formed, and as you can imagine, it has long-term health consequences. Experts say it's more likely to affect kids growing up in poverty. And they warn that toxic stress is possibly the next big public health issue. One way to mitigate the effects of toxic stress is through building strong, positive relationships. Daisy Rosario visited a state that is making that a priority.
The term public health sounds kind of wonky, but it affects the health of everyone. It's the government's efforts to keep us well. So when California banned smoking in restaurants and bars, or New York put up posters about the dangers of sugar, those were public health decisions. One state is trying to make a different change.
My name is Tonette Walker, and I'm the First Lady of the state of Wisconsin.
Tonette Walker is married to Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. When she became First Lady, a lot of people started asking her to get involved in their causes.
But what I realized was that you needed to pick something. If you were really going to make a difference, you had to pick one or two causes.
One day, the First Lady had breakfast with two women who run nonprofits that aim to improve the lives of children and families. They told the First Lady about children who suffered abuse, about foster care and children at risk, and how she could help.
I think I sat at this coffee shop in my hometown in Wauwatosa and thought, oh my gosh, this is it. This is what I'm going to work on. This is what I'm going to focus on.
Together, the three women decided to start something called Fostering Futures. Fostering Futures is sort of a group. Some people I interviewed called it a steering committee. Essentially, it's a mix of people who represent both public and private interests in Wisconsin. They meet and figure out how to work together towards the goal of helping Wisconsin children and families, especially those within the foster care system. But they don't only talk to each other.
We listen to the biological parents. We listen to the foster parents. We listen to the children. We also listen to the therapists also because they were on the ground doing the work.
If toxic stress is the body's response to long-term adversity, absence of stable and consistent help and support, then children in foster care are at very high risk for toxic stress. Think about it. Their lives are unstable. The biological parent is, for whatever reason, unable to care for the child, at least for a while. And when it comes to public health, foster kids come into contact with more parts of the system than the average child. They're being looked after by the state, they go to public schools, they're on Medicaid, and anytime a kid ends up in foster care, family court is involved. But while these kids are interacting with almost every part of the system, the First Lady soon found that the systems themselves weren't doing much to communicate with each other.
I was a little shocked about, what do you mean you don't talk? Or what do you mean you don't share? Why is that so difficult? Why is it so difficult to ask judges and legislators and everyone to come together and talk about the same issue?
And this is what Fostering Futures really does. It brings everyone it can to the table, and it raises awareness about trauma-informed care. Trauma-informed care is essentially a philosophy that you can put into practice. It's a sort of holistic approach to treating and working with people who have experienced trauma. When it comes to foster care, it asks that you acknowledge the experience of the children and families you're dealing with, to understand that people's behaviors might be a reaction to the things that happened to them and not a conscious choice. It also necessitates collaboration.
They learn from us, we learn from them. I don't think you can have any one system, you know, siloed and working alone to try to deal with this.
This is Mary Trigiano. She's a judge in Milwaukee Children's Court. She's worked with Fostering Futures, but her interest in the effects of trauma initially came from her own work.
When I first started out at Children's Court and started to think about kids who committed crimes and why, and families who I know loved their children but were neglecting them or hurting them.
This approach is gaining popularity, in part because of the ACEs study. ACEs stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences. The more of these a person experiences, the more likely they are to have severe health issues, face addiction, even die younger. And the ACEs study helped lead to the research around toxic stress. It's this research on toxic stress that gave people like Judge Trigiano and others hard scientific information to back up what they'd seen in their work. Now, Wisconsin's goal is to get everyone that could be involved to be trauma-informed. For many, this may seem like common sense, but it's not the way these systems were built. And it's this kind of big-picture team approach that is especially important when dealing with foster kids.
And I think we border on a lot of unintended consequences that we don't realize when we think we can do this work on our own.
For example, if a single parent ends up in jail, what happens to their child?
You know, a parent may be thrown in jail for being caught with heroin, but that impacts the child as well because then the child can't see the parent or needs to be removed.
In addition to Children's Court, Judge Trigiano presides over Family Drug Treatment Court. It's a model that started in Nevada in the mid-90s and has spread around the country. Instead of just punishing the offender, judges, social workers, lawyers, and others work together with the goal of keeping the parent clean and getting the family back together. They celebrate when the person is doing well and try to help them stay on track. One person described it to me as a court date and an AA meeting combined. Judge Trigiano says that when we just tell people what to do without understanding the situation,
they're not going to get better, and we see them over and over again. And then they can't safely parent their child. And then their child's impacted by their own trauma, and it becomes this vicious cycle of, you know, us churning people out and things not working. We still believe accountability and public safety are key, but how do we work with that to get the best results possible and change behavior?
For Judge Trigiano, it's not about being softer. It's about being smarter.
Yeah, I like that soft, touchy-feely kind of language, which, you know, I actually find drug treatment court, while it might be considered touchy-feely by some, it's harder than hell.
Hard, she says, for many reasons. But a big one is that it makes judges and lawyers more invested. People become much more than just a case. Joanna Stevens also sees this in her job as the Family Relations Coordinator for the Office of Children's Mental Health.
When there's somebody with lived experience at that table, you notice a higher level of respect. Their language changes.
She works with children and families to bring their voices to other offices, including the people who make up Fostering Futures, so that decisions aren't being made without feedback from those affected. Ms. Stevens is herself one of those voices of lived experience. After her second child passed away, her oldest, a daughter, would act out.
And then when we were interacting with the schools, they saw a bad child willfully making, you know, bad decisions, really explicitly saying that you can't say what happened to her at 2 years old is having any effect on her today. This is just a bad kid.
Ms. Stevens's experience is trying to fit into a system that didn't understand her family made her feel like a failure. Now, critics may say that this sort of a trauma-informed approach gives people excuses for their behavior. But for Ms. Stevens and her family, it was more like a diagnosis. It explained why her daughter acted the way she did and helped Ms. Stevens recognize her own traumas.
Once I understood the brain biology and what was happening in my system, that's where I was able to be accountable.
Ms. Stevens' boss, Elizabeth Hudson, wants people to know that trauma-informed care is more than just a new tool.
This is something much bigger, and it's about a consciousness change versus a maintaining the system and just adding another component to the existing system.
The story of toxic stress and trauma-informed care in Wisconsin is really a story about relationships, not just between those who need services and those who provide them, but as the First Lady says, between everyone who could possibly touch the life of a child.
We need to get everyone from the top down and the bottom up thinking about trauma-informed care. So for us, it's the bus driver, it's the school teacher, it's the Department of Public Instruction, it's it's the president of the organization, all thinking about trauma-informed care.
And in Wisconsin, it's a story that's just beginning.
Latino USA senior producer Daisy Rosario. And if you want to better understand toxic stress, check out Daisy's other stories on the topic on our website, latinousa.org. Now, it may not be a place that immediately comes to mind when you think about Latinos, but Wisconsin, and especially Milwaukee, has a thriving Latino population. Lilia Figueroa is a mentor at St. A, which is a group that handles half of Milwaukee's foster care cases. Lilia started her career with St. A as one of the few bilingual case managers.
My first case with a Spanish-speaking family was interesting. I had, I think they were 3, 5, and 6. Mom had some drug history and a lot of domestic violence in her past, but she was very inconsistent to the point where her oldest one got such anxiety from knowing when she was supposed to visit, and if she didn't come, he would have continued accidents at school. I had to have the conversation with mom. Like, I know you love your kids, and your kids love you, but your oldest child is having these behaviors at school because he's having this anxiety from, I'm supposed to see mom today, but then you don't show up or you cancel at the last minute and he loses it. It really took for her to understand me saying that to her, for her to get it, like, my actions are impacting my kids, and she didn't see it like that before. We were able to send those kids home, and then sadly, after we closed out the case, mom ended up dying, and they came back into care. The kids were in the home when she died. They witnessed. She had engaged in very, very hard drugs that she had never used before with a significant other, and overdosed. Our main objective at that point was trying to find a foster home to keep them together, just given the fact that they had gone through this horrible experience witnessing their mother essentially overdose. But it was hard on me because I didn't realize how much it was going to hit me. There were moments where I had to take him to doctor's appointments and they would see a needle and it would take him back to when mom overdosed, and I had to be there to try to help them through that. So it was traumatic for not only them but for myself as well, knowing that I was also a reminder to them of their mother. I know that the last time I heard they were doing really well, because with our policy, once we close out a case, we're not able to stay connected. I have one foster mom that emails me once in a while now. She adopted my last case that I had, a little girl who was severely physically abused by her mother to the point where, I mean, she should have died. She was in the hospital for over a month, and she was only 22 months at the time, severely malnourished. Her hair was falling out, multiple rib fractures, broken hip. And she updates me a lot on her recovery. She's able to walk now, and to see those milestones for her was amazing. And that foster mom, she was actually her emergency room nurse who adopted her as well. And so it's a very amazing story. I think she'll always carry a memory, maybe deep down. She had a lot of cigarette burns, and she's 3 now. She gets very angry when she sees them. I think social workers are very much unsung heroes for a lot of families. It's rewarding. I can't describe it. I mean, there are days where I've cried out of frustration, but then there are the days and the moments where I've cried because I'm just happy for what my parents have accomplished, what my kids have accomplished. To be a witness to that is a miracle in itself, I feel.
Thanks to Lilia Figueroa for sharing those stories with us. And coming up on Latino USA, what happens when you and your partner work mere feet from your bedroom?
We are like arguing about something in our pajamas, and then Katina says, okay, that's it, I'm going to sleep. And then, and then 5 steps later, she's in bed.
Stay with us. No te vayas. Hey. Hey, thanks for listening to Latino USA. And if you like us, take a listen to our friends over at Alt Latino. It's a weekly dive into the world of Latin alternative music and culture, featuring sounds like psychedelic tropical music from Peru or Mexican folk rhythms mixed with electronica. Hear from the artists changing and challenging the established order of Latin music. That's Alt Latino from NPR Music every week at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
When I'm walking, I'm strong as tough. Yeah, I'm so strung out. I'm high as a kite. I just might stop to shake you out. Let go. Sound. Let me go. My hands, I know you're the one. Body and beats, I stain my teeth. I don't even know why. My girlfriend is at the end. She is starting to cry. Let go.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Walton Family Foundation, working to prepare all students for a lifetime of opportunity by ensuring access to high-quality K-12 choices. More information is available at waltonk12.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and we've been talking a lot about different types of relationships. But what happens when a romantic relationship is also a professional one? Otmaro Ruiz and his wife Cachinha de Luna are both musicians, Latin jazz musicians. They had their own separate music careers, which worked great for them. Then recently, they decided to do something different, to record and produce an album together, right in their own home. They thought it would be a fun project, a way to bond creatively as husband and wife. And then something happened that they didn't expect at all. Here's Otmaro and Cachinha.
The idea of putting this concept together was like a little bit of a casual invitation from a friend of ours to put together a band. It was so much fun that we decided, wow, this could be an interesting project. Bringing Brazilian traditional songs that have been iconic, like for instance, the song that is nominated for Best Arrangement in the Grammys is The Girl from Ipanema, which has been recorded over and over and over and over for so many years, and we decided to give it a total different makeover.
Que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça, ela menina que vem e que passa num doce balanço a caminho.
We did this project with very, very little resources. We have our home studio, but everybody pretty much volunteered their talents.
We were sleeping and we got a call. Usually our home telephone number is just telemarketing, so we were like totally ignoring the telephone, you know, and said, who is calling? Who is calling so many times? And finally we decided to pick it up. And it was a friend of ours saying, well, congratulations. I said, why congratulations? Well, you were nominated for the Grammys.
Tem amigo de Olinda que se chama Alfredo.
So then we woke up and decided to check online if this was true.
The shock of waking up that morning with the nomination
was an incredible feeling. And we were not even members of the Academy, so it was submitted by friends of ours that supported us, too. Usually, people that make CDs that get submitted for Grammys, they are supported by big record labels that know everything about the key dates of submission, of releasing the products. We didn't even have anything set up in terms of PR or promotion or anything. We didn't have that ambition. This was such a labor of love. It was just our little project.
Foi um sinal bem triste, morena, fiquei a imaginar. Será que é o nosso amor, morena, que vai se acabar? Você bem sabe que a Emma, quando canta, vem trazendo no seu canto bocado de azar. Eu tenho medo, morena, eu tenho medo.
Recording an album together, it's a proof of love, because it's not easy.
Bear in mind that our studio is just a few steps from our bedroom. So imagine making a crucial recording at 2 a.m. We are like arguing about something in our pajamas, and then Katina says, okay, that's it, I'm going to sleep. And then and then 5 steps later, she's in bed.
It's ingredients for fights every day. So if you really don't love the person who you are with, you know, most likely the marriage will not survive. So you gotta love a lot to be able to work together.
Most people hire therapists, but I think that one of the most amazing things that you can do is just try to record an album together, because if you come out the other end still together, the marriage is so much stronger then.
So you never know. The next time you decide to record an album in your basement with your partner, you could come out with a Grammy. Katchina and Otmaro's album is called Katchina de Luna and Lado B Brazilian Project. And in fact, it wasn't just nominated for one Grammy, it was nominated for 6 of them, including the Grammys for Best Latin Jazz Album and Best Vocal and Instrumental Arrangement. And if you want to learn more about Otmaro and Katchina's music, stop by our website, latinousa.org. So, my dear listener, if you've been listening over the past 4 years and you've listened to the credits, then you've probably heard me say this. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. It's true. For the last 4 years, Nancy has worked behind the scenes as our office coordinator and my assistant. And one day, we decided that simply crediting her at the end of our show by saying office coordinator didn't really convey just how crucial Nancy was to our entire operation. Because Nancy really does make it all happen. Yes, she orders the extra supplies, she picks up our mail, she books our flights, and everyone turns to her when the internet goes down. But Nancy also keeps us grounded, first with her huge smile every day, then by bringing in food to the office unannounced, like chicharrón or pupusas or tamales. She's the one that organizes everybody's birthday surprise, and she definitely keeps us entertained with her fascination of the Minions. But now Nancy's decided that it's not about making it all happen at Futuro. Right now, it's all about making it happen for Nancy's life. And so she's leaving, and we're sad to let her go. Let me tell you a little bit about the backstory. I met Nancy when I wanted to do a story for Latino USA about what it is to grow up as a Mexican teenager in New York. That was almost 10 years ago. Back then, Nancy was a high school artist. She was accepted to go to Barnard College, which was my alma mater. And she was this young, hip, Mexican teenage New Yorker. So later, I hired Nancy to tutor my kids. And well, she became really close with my entire family. And then 4 years ago, I hired Nancy to be my first ever assistant. Speaking from my own perspective, Nancy's been absolutely invaluable in my life. So before Nancy left, I decided to turn the microphone back on her, and I let her deliver her own sabiduría, or words of wisdom, to everyone. Because after all, Nancy did come into the office very often wearing her Wise Latina t-shirt. Here's Nancy Trujillo for all of you. And, fair warning, we were already crying just when we started to roll tape.
I've been here for 4 years. I've seen people come. I've seen people go. I've put together those desks that everyone is using. I've seen this place grow. And to leave is never easy, especially when you care. And that's why I'm crying. And that's what I feel. I feel love to and from people.
There's something that is pulling you. There's a place where you want to go. And I want to know what. I mean, this morning you posted something so beautiful. It was a quote from a poem, right?
Follow your soul?
Yeah. It knows the way. And so I'm like, where is Nancy's soul taking her? And yet, you know, I told you, I think that the thing that has helped me understand your leaving the most is actually Nurse Jackie. Sorry, I'm going to kill it for everybody. But, you know, she can't deal with the fact that her young collaborator decides not to continue on with Nurse Jackie. And she says, I got to do me, and I got to do me without you. And I was like, okay, that's what's happening. Nancy has to do Nancy, and she has to do it without me, who has been a presence in her life intensely for the last 4 years. But my question is, like, where is your soul pulling you?
To saving the world and baking cookies. People joke around and people always laugh when they hear me say that. And I'm like, okay, maybe I sound like a five-year-old, you know, thinking, still believing in Santa Claus and thinking of unicorns. But I want to help people. I want to empower them and motivate them. I want to help them realize the power that they have. You know, you have the opportunity to make the day whatever you make it. You don't always really decide how it starts, but you always decide how it ends. You know, if I'm going to go to bed every single night crying, that was my decision. But if I go to bed saying goodnight to all the people I love, I decided to do that. I decided to rest in peace. And people in all walks of life should be able to do that, you know, from the person who knows that they have it to the person who's lost in their sorrow, who's lost in their hurt, who's lost in their circumstances.
You know, Nancy, I love the story. I've told it thousands of times, I would say at this point, the story of how you were named, you know, after Nancy Reagan. And then oftentimes people just go like, what? And then it's like, because Ronald Reagan created an immigration reform that allowed for a path to citizenship for your parents, which is why they are documented and why you have had a pretty amazing experience of being a Mexicana with all the rights of, because you're a U.S. citizen. But I want to know about the strength that you draw at your core. Is it from your mom? Is it from your dad? Is it from understanding that experience? Where does it come from?
I told you once that when I think that I'm going through the hardest times in my life, I think of my 15-year-old mother and my 20-year-old father leaving their home. They both have a sixth grade education because they weren't able, like many people, to keep on learning because there wasn't enough money to eat. And I think of them making a decision. I'm going to walk however many miles I need to across that desert and probably die because that's the price they might have had to pay and come to this country, a country that was promised to them as a place of opportunity, a place to create wealth. And the only wealth they were seeking was to be able to feed their family. Bread. They wanted to pay for bread, for tortillas. And I think of my mother and my father crossing the border. And I think, wow, they were cold. They were scared. They were alone. And those are the things Those are the worst possible things that any human being can ever go through. Hunger, feeling alone, and being cold. And I say, okay, if the hardest thing for me to do this morning is to, I don't know, ride my bike across a Triborough Bridge to get to work, I got it pretty easy. I got this. That is where I get my strength from knowing that because of my parents, I'm their dream. I'm their American dream. I'm what they came to this country for, to make sure that their daughters got an education, to make sure that they were responsible citizens of the world, and that they gave back and understood that they came from a very humble beginning.
What has it been like to become the glue of an organization like Futuro? Because you've been here for 4 years. You were with us from the very beginning when we started, a year in when we really had no clue what we were doing, nor what it was. I had never had an assistant. You had never been one. You have become the glue of this place. And what has that been like for you?
After 4 years, I realized that it was never a conscious thing that I was building. That I'm a glue because that's who I am, because I'm a caretaker, I'm a giver, I'm a sharer. That was never part of the job description, you know, to make sure that people took time to eat, making sure you sleep enough, making sure that we take a time out of our days to celebrate birthdays. You don't consciously make the decision to be the glue. You just are.
What are you going to miss the most? And what are you not going to miss at all?
I'm not going to miss,
truthfully,
expense reports. I am going to miss, oh my God, I'm going to miss a family.
The words of Nancy Trujillo. And I'm going to try to get through this without crying, everyone, because I wish Nancy nothing but the best, and I expect nothing but total dedication like what she's given to Futuro Media. We love you, Nancy. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Fernanda Chavarri, Michael Simon Johnson, Antonia Cerejido, Zakia Gibbons, and Sarah Barrett. Julia Hsu is our production assistant. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music editor. And our new office coordinator is John Guardo. And John, we're really happy that you're here with us. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on my Instagram, Maria_la_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all.
And so then if doubt gets raised, and how typically what are the signs of doubt? What are the things that they might think, this is not?
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles in hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And American Jewish World Service, working for 30 years to end poverty and advance human rights worldwide. Learn more at ajws.org. This is NPR.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, we dive deep into the rhetoric of fear in the presidential election.
I think it's the worst that we've seen, but I think that we need to be very careful not to say from there that we've never seen anything like this before.
That's next time on Latino USA.